This is Book Public from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. On this episode, I speak to Dan Simon, the author of the novel Ashland. Ashland is a real place. There are many places in the United States named Ashland, but they are not like Ashland, New Hampshire. It's a mill town in the Lakes region, and it's home to the six narrators that Dan Simon brings to us in this marvelous book. In Ashland, Simon leaves behind basic narrative and plot conventions. Six people from Ashland speak. Each one shares their story about living in Ashland, living through what they have been born into and revealing the ways they have survived the worst of it and managed with a sense of satisfaction and maybe even a measure of hometown pride. Certainly, there is love in what they share. Carolyn is one of the narrators. She was born to a teenage single mom and never knew her father. That loss and the relationship she has with her mother and paternal grandmother make Carolyn an introspective person. She's a noticer. She writes down her observations and experiences. She's a writer. But beyond that, she impresses her writing professor at Plymouth State University, another real place, with her talent. What else is there to glean from Carolyn, but also the others, Jenny, Andy, Gordon, Edith, and Jeff? Oh, plenty. Stories are sacred as our sense of home is. Ashland is a place where we'd all like to stay a while because of the things these characters share and even the things they can't quite say. But oh, what they do say. Dan Simon gives voices to characters we don't see often enough in literature. They get to tell their own story. He gives them dimension and depth, intelligence and compassion. They're flawed, too, like we all are. And the humanity he gives to them for the ways they grapple with life's mysteries reveals to readers the power of literature and the sheer beauty in their struggle and their will to live life with meaning. I spoke to Dan Simon about his novel, Ashland. Would you set the table for us and tell us a little bit about Ashland? What do you say when people ask you what this book is about?
Here's what I would say. The seed of this story is a young person who grows up without knowing their father. That's the seed. And then I'm going to jump and say the next thing that I think is important to say is that to get the book right, I do feel I've gotten the book right. And to get the book right, what I needed to do was tear away and discard all the usual conventions of narrative fiction. You know, to keep the story alive in the way that it is in Ashland, I had to throw away all the conventions. So what I mean by that is, as you I'm sure noticed, practically the whole book is written in the present tense. It goes forward, it goes back decades, but pretty much the whole book is written in the present tense, and naturally so. There's no narration. It's just people speaking. There's almost no physical description of people. So you probably didn't notice it, but nobody says at any point in the book what Carolyn looks like or what Gordon or Andy or Jenny looks like. The only dialogue in the book is secondhand. It's people recalling conversations. There's no dialogue, no narration. So that's how I had to bring the book to life, was to throw away a lot of the usual things that tie stories together. I know everything that happens in this book and when it happens and who these people are. But, you know, to give you an extreme example, there's one death in particular that's central to the book. I don't want to spoil it. You know the death that I'm talking about. We don't know how that death happens. And I can tell you that was very freeing and important. And it's almost as if you were imagining this person up in heaven. I just mean, you know, whether we believe in heaven or not, but if you imagine this person looking down, would this person want people to know how they died? I feel that they wouldn't want people to know that. I feel that what's more important to know is what that person did that day, which was to go on a long walk with her daughter, with their daughter and with their niece. That's what's important to know about that day, not how that person died. So, you know, you can hear I speak about it with passion. I can't help myself. But so that's how this book really came to life, is by throwing away a lot of the usual things that help people get to the story. And yet, I think the story is perfectly clear. And we know what happens to everyone through their own perceptions of what happens to themselves. You know, so it's kind of like people's interior voices speaking. That's the form here. And it is kind of radical. However, I haven't had anybody complain about it. It's not confusing. And I think that's beautiful because people fall into it naturally and it somehow, you know, they don't struggle with it. It just kind of feels natural, I hope.
It does. It's so interesting that you're saying this about how liberating it is not to have to pin somebody's whole life and existence on the way that they died.
Or the way they look.
Or the way that they look, exactly. And to sort of discard the conventions of the narrative, it takes absolutely nothing away from the reading experience. I think it adds to it. You fall into it, and it's mesmeric. I mean, I don't even know how to describe the experience of you open the book and you start to read and you're hearing from Carolyn and then you hear from Carolyn again at a different time. And it is, you're right, extremely present. And it is present tense. And it just keeps you not in the action, but in how do I say this? It is her interior monologue, let's say, but the lyricism of this and the poetry in this. And I think to say that is to kind of diminish really the experience for me. I don't know what else to say. And I don't have a question about this, except I can totally understand the idea of it being liberating, because this is Ashland. This is a very particular place in very particular times, very particular moments in the lives of these people. And you give a story and a voice to people. I think that, I'm sorry, but I just don't think we read about characters like this enough, that they have this level of intelligence, that they have this level of sharpness and introspection. Mm. I love that. In fact, I had this idea that the socioeconomic story in this novel is very powerful on its own too. And it's something that we can hear even through Carolyn. You make these characters in this rather depressed place sensitive, compassionate, very introspective. They reflect and they remember. And that means something to me in terms of our world today, where sometimes we see people so diminished, so boiled down to one thing, their citizenship, their language, the color of their skin, the job that they do, without somehow also realizing the profound ways that they reflect, they feel, they think, they respond to the world around them, to the wider world, even well beyond the confines of Ashland, through books and through stories and through the library.
The way I like to think about it is, well, let me say, first of all, Ashland is a real place.
Yeah.
It's a real town. It exists. It's pretty much the geographical center of New Hampshire. New Hampshire is an odd-shaped state, so it's in the north, but it's the beginning of the north. So it kind of looks both ways. And, you know, north to the kind of more sparsely populated, colder, wilder land, and south to the, you know, southern New Hampshire, which is more densely populated, closer to Boston, that sort of thing. But I like to think of it as there's good things that will happen to Ashland that haven't happened yet. So for a long, long, long time, let's say two centuries, more or less, it hasn't changed. I mean, of course it's changed, but in other ways, it hasn't changed and it hasn't found itself yet, but that will come. It's a hard luck town surrounded by towns that are more comfortable and that have benefited from being places that people might retire to. I'm thinking of a town called Meredith, which is about a half hour away, or a town called Holderness, which is just a few minutes away. You know, these are pretty places on lakes. That hasn't happened to Ashland. It's not a place that you might retire to. It just isn't. And it is a place that I love and that I grew up. And so part of the feeling in the book is of a child looking at adults, because that's what I was when I was there, and the adults were people that I was in awe of, that I might just see in passing, you know, local men and women and kids, but I was passionately interested in them. And the point of view in Ashland is, you know, as you, I think, mentioned, the book is told in the first person in, you could say, monologues. I like to say soliloquies, from the points of view of six different characters. And, you know, it's their interior life, and they are smart, and they have, I'm thinking of Carolyn now in particular, I'm waiting for somebody to tell me she's funny. And the reason I think she's very funny is her intelligence, but also she's willing to kind of put herself at risk. Her whole life isn't about making sure she's okay. Her whole life is about learning things she didn't know before, finding out who she is, understanding the connection she feels to the land, you know, to the weather, to the land, to the people around her. That's more important to her than making sure that she survives her own, you know, coming into adulthood. And so, you know, she is willing to put herself at risk in order to find out the things she needs to find out. I would say that's really what I love about her. And, you know, but she can not put herself down, but she can accept, you know, she's not trying to put herself first. She's just trying to live her life and find out what it's going to be. And so it's really a question whether she's going to survive or not. You know, it's not something that you would assume. And also she grows up without a father. And so, you know, the way that she does survive, you know, the way that she is able to kind of lead her life is by leaning on the people around her. And it's not that they're necessarily so concerned with her, but she's concerned with them. So she draws from them, from Edith, who's a much older woman, from her mother, from her aunt, from Edith's husband, Gordon, from the people around her, from her writing teacher to some extent. So she's, like you say, she's kind of a down-to-earth, regular person. And boy, is she smart, and boy, is she strong.
She is that. She is all of those things. And she is a writer. And Plymouth State is a real place, too.
It's also a real place.
Very real place.
Yeah.
And she's a writer, and she goes to school, and Jeff is the writing teacher. And I was really struck by this line, and I'm just going to paraphrase it. It's something about how he talks about, you know, sort of the plight of the writing teacher sometimes, who is a writing teacher, but maybe not a writer sometimes because of the vocation, but recognizes something in her and says, you know, something like, I really don't have anything to teach her. It's not like a pupil, like, you know, somebody who he has to make sure gets to the class on time and turns everything in and these kinds of things. But instead, he says he just bears witness to the things that she is able to do and convey in her writing.
That's exactly right.
That's just so beautiful. And that's so real. That's a very real thing that happens sometimes.
You know, the thing about, she is a writer, Carolyn is a writer, and maybe that is what saves her. And certainly this book it belongs to her in that sense. I mean, I'm kind of two minds, Yvette, in terms of that question. To me, each of the six characters are equally important.
Yes.
Carolyn, who probably has 100 pages, you know, half the book, but Edith, who has 4 pages, everybody's equally important.
Yes.
That's very important to me. At the same time, what we as readers experience here is, in a sense, Carolyn's writing. And her writing is, you know, very normal to me, but it's, you know, it's also in a way unusual. She calls it collecting things. You know, she's just collecting her observations, her experiences. She a little bit makes light of a lot of the books she reads, a lot of the storytelling. You know, she reads romances. She says they're just so funny. In other words, she enjoys them, but they're not about real life. I think that's what she finds so funny about them. And she says, you know, she likes mysteries. You know, she just picks up anything. There was never one important book, she says. It's not like somebody said, oh, you have to read, you know, Jane Austen or whatever it might be. No, she's just reading at the same time as there's kind of an engine inside her, which is her writing, which itself is a kind of work that she kind of made up on her own. And yes, her writing teacher, who thinks she's very special, he just doesn't want to touch that. And it's something I believe also, which is this is work. So what writers do is work. It's not so different from what, you know, a cobbler, you know, somebody who makes shoes or somebody who makes houses does. It's work. It's labor. You do your job. So I think we would be better off as a society if we started kind of idolizing, not that we idolize writers that much these days, but I mean, you know, actors, writers too, in our community, you and I know we do kind of idolize the writers that we idolize. And, you know, writers are doing a job. I think one could imagine a healthier relationship where one person is a, you know, a builder or postman, whatever it is, and they do their work and a writer does the work that writers do and everybody's kind of equal and you do your job. Yeah. It's labor. It's physical labor.
It is. And that's a line from the book, too, about the physical labor of it. I'm looking at exactly the part I think you were referencing. I grow up reading books. I'm always stopping by the Ashland Town Library after school. I know people will say they were changed by one particular book they read. But for me, it isn't like that. I read everything I can get my hands on. There's no one book. You know, I underlined there's no one book. And I'm going to confess to you that for just half a second, it bothered me. And then I kept reading, and then it didn't bother me anymore.
I love that.
So it's so beautiful.
There's another section, if I can find it, where, yes, I know where it is, where she talks about reading, and which is on page 33 and 34. So this is also Carolyn speaking. Also early in the book, which the section you just read was, she says, look at the mountains, just look at them. That's how long it takes to do anything that will last. It isn't any different for us. We need many, many lifetimes, but we only get one. To me, my afternoon's reading with my father's mother in town sometimes, beside Mama a lot, with Edith. The afternoon's reading with these women I trust completely is as close as I could ever get to the other side of the problem of living, and that's writing. You watch the stories unfold. Reading is something we do, a spiritual exercise. With Jeff, that's her writing teacher, I'm having this experience with a man for the first time. My brain resists this, and my heart resists this. I am synchronized in my refusal of the idea of a man being able to do this with the necessary tenderness. You have to imagine something first in order to experience it, even when you smash right up against it. A man's tenderness does exist in the same way as talking animals do. You can see it in their eyes. I do believe in the existence of tender-hearted men. I believe they're everywhere, all around us, and animals that can speak intelligently to us of what they see and what they experience and what their experience is. You just have to be able to understand the ways they communicate these things to us. I mean, it's her humor too, you know?
Yeah.
She means every word. It's very matter of fact. Carolyn is very matter of fact, but she's also funny as hell. And, you know, this thing kind of sort of saying, you know, she's used to reading with women. It's kind of new to trust men in that way. And the way she tries to understand it is comparing the intelligence in men's eyes with the intelligence in animals' eyes and saying they can both communicate to you with tenderness. You just got to kind of figure out how to understand them. I'm sorry, but it's funny. She means it. She means every word, but it's also funny. And she's also kind of, it's a dig at men, obviously, too.
Yes.
But she does it in a funny way.
But it's funny and it's fair and it's profound and it's very wise. And I was thinking about the reference to Mae Sarton.
Mm.
And I've been wanting to ask you about this. So just an aside, her book, Journal of a Solitude, means a lot to me personally.
You're special. I mean, not many people these days know that book, but yeah.
I was away alone at a residency for 4 months at the end of 2024. And I took my little paperback of Journal of a Solitude. And even though I didn't try to read entries synchronously on a particular day, I tried to read from that book every day, kind of randomly. And I was really struck by the resonance on any particular day. So February...
She's so good.
Yeah. And there was something of the humor that's in the very direct language, or the very direct language that's describing something absurd or narrating something that's a little bit absurd. So I'm not going to bore you with this, but I opened February 13th, since we're doing this interview on February 13th, and she says this house is full of spring flowers, Valentines. There is no month when I can imagine spring flowers being more of a delight. Yesterday, the trees were sheathed in ice, and it is bitterly cold. So the freshness, the aliveness of daffodils and iris and tulips indoors is quite overwhelming. Even the rich green leaves and the scent in this frozen, odorless world seem like marvels. That put me in the mind of the descriptions of the natural world that Carolyn gives us in the book. And then I have been pondering two passages from Jung. The first is the key to the dangers of sublimation. One does not become enlightened by imagining figures of light, but by making the darkness conscious. And there was something, maybe I'm trying too hard to connect the dots, but there, when I read that and I was thinking about Ashlyn and about talking to you, something made me think about what Jenny says. If you want happiness, go for it, but accept that it may come at the price of unbearable misery. And that is the case if you consider a person who chooses to stay put and be part of the fabric of a town and a family where things are difficult, or the person even who ventures out and breaks away. I think in both cases, something is lost and something is gained. But there's something with all of these characters, this whole world that you've built for us around this very real idea about how we live, what we've lost, and of course, as you say, the center of this is this big gaping hole in the life of Carolyn. Of course, that is the plight of us all. We all carry around our losses and try to live our lives sort of around those things. I don't know what I'm trying to say, except that there's just something so resonant here. I'm down here in San Antonio, Texas, and I speak the language of these people from Ashland. I understand, and it's something exciting, not in a kind of a self-centered way, but just in a way that makes me feel happy somehow.
It's really wonderful to hear. You're spot on. I mean, you know, there are many beating hearts in this book, but Jenny's in some ways the beating heart of the book. And, you know, and so, and that sentence and other things that she says, very important. But I want to, I mean, how do we survive? I mean, to me, Ashland is a book about survival. How do we survive? We're survivors. How do we survive? How do we take our losses? You know, there's another passage, not from Jenny, but from Andy, where he talks about boulders that collapse into three pieces, which I've seen happen. It happens. You never think it would be possible, and then it happens. You know, piece of granite just collapsing. And he compares it to a man having a heart attack. And he says, you know, yeah, I saw a man have a heart attack once. And it was like when a boulder collapses. And he says, I'm paraphrasing, I don't have it in front of me, but he says, you know, we're made of bone and flesh, but we're also made of stone. And, or maybe he says it the other way around, but, you know, one of the things, and I've been wanting to say this, listening to some of the comments you've been making and the passages you've been reading, one of the things about New Hampshire, and this is, I'll bet also true about Texas, or maybe true about Texas, is that one of the ways that people survive is by leaning on and being changed by the land around us and the extreme weather conditions and, you know, the trees and the mountains. So these things that are not coming from fellow humans have really shaped the character of people in New Hampshire. And I'm not the first person to say that. There are histories, you know, but there's not much in the way of New Hampshire history in book form. Most of the things that I write about in this book that are historical do not appear in history books, even though they are the history during this period of New Hampshire. Things like, you know, I-93, which is the highway that over a period of several decades was built south to north in New Hampshire, and, you know, other changes, the closure of the mills, the ending or virtual ending of agricultural life in New Hampshire that happened over the course of, you could say, a century, but really it was, again, a matter of decades, where this land that had been really an agricultural state, farming, sheep farming in the early 19th century, and then, you know, cattle, corn everywhere, fields of corn, and then that just ended. I mean, it ended quite suddenly because we couldn't compete with the kind of agribusiness farms out in the West. So, but there is some history in New Hampshire. And as I said, I read in a quite good history, short one, this notion of people being formed, people in New Hampshire being formed by the woods, by the wild, the wilderness. And I thought that was quite shocking to read it, but it's true.
Wow.
And when I say I thought it was shocking to read it, I mean, I was shocked to read it from a historian. It's the kind of thing that embodies what I write in Ashland. You know, there is this give and take between people and the land, and the conversation that happens between the people and the land in New Hampshire is constantly a dynamic process, because guess what? The weather changes from one week to the next. It's extremely cold. It is brutally, violently cold in the winter. And, you know, quite a lot's been written about that. We know about that. But what people also forget is that it's glorious and gentle and kind of bounteous in the summer.
Wow.
And the summer is a long summer. It's not Alaska summer short. So, you know, the people over generations in New Hampshire are formed by the extreme bitter cold of the winter, and then how that alternates with this kind of, in many ways, paradisical summer. I mean, of course, there are ironies in that, which relate to the kind of, if you want to be happy, be prepared to be miserable too, for Jenny, which is that, guess what the trees are mostly suffering from in New Hampshire? It's not the cold winters. No, it's the warm summers because of, you know, infestations that happen in the summer. The ironies abound, but we are in New Hampshire, a place that is really, if we are saved, which is kind of another funny thing, because it's a very good moment for New Hampshire right now. Economically, the population's growing, not too fast, but it's growing. And so people in New Hampshire are very proud right now in a way I could never have predicted 20, 30, 40 years ago. And I think part of that is because of this way that people in New Hampshire have learned how to learn from our physical surroundings, from the weather and the land. And I don't know if that rings a bell in terms of Texas, but I have a feeling it might.
It does. Yeah, it does. And I love to imagine some of these people in the spaces of a New Hampshire that's doing really well, that's doing better.
I mean, I would never have predicted it.
Yeah.
Because most of the time when this book takes place, which is really largely the 90s, I mean, you know, leading up to the 90s, but basically the 90s was a really tough time economically in New Hampshire, and not just economically, but spiritually, you know, because we were a state that depended on its mills, and we were a state that depended on agriculture and was proud of its agriculture, and those both basically ended. So what do you do? You know, so it was a very tough time. But, you know, this phenomenon, I mean, where we are also, I wanted to say, the country around Ashland, it's called the Lakes Region, not by me and not by people who grew up there. You know, that's a kind of tourist expression, more for the vacationers, but it is called the Lakes Region. And indeed, this is the area that is filled with lakes and rivers because north of us is the White Mountains and that wilderness. So the water kind of comes down. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is a land that is a land of mountains, small mountains where we are, larger north of us, and water. And so that's also just extremely important. If you can imagine coming there, you know, at the end of this, let's say the 17th, anytime from the 1690s, 1700s, and it was a forbidding land, and there were no roads in the early, very few roads in the early 1700s, virtually none in the late 1600s, but you still had the water. So you were going to get beaten up by the weather, and you didn't know how to, you know, respond really, but the saving grace of the water, which was, you know, a navigable for boats, but also just the gentleness of it, you know, very important.
I want to ask you about something that I watched a video of, a conversation with you and Colin Asher and Russell Banks talking about Nelson Algren. And in that conversation, in talking about what can be taken for sentimentality, you said that we need lyricism and poetry, that we need it in our work, and that we need, you said, that kind of weakness for humanity. I was so struck by that, I never forgot it.
Thank you so much.
And I was thinking about, when I was reading the novel and I saw, maybe I don't know, maybe I had pricked up my ears for any mention of poetry. Carolyn in 1992 says that she likes to read poetry books. She says, I find them deeply factual. And that brought me back to your quote. And just by sheer happenstance today, I was scrolling on social media and I saw a quote by a poet named Victoria Cornick who said, I wrote poetry to replicate the way my life felt. I needed prose to help me understand it. And I felt like that was a sort of an echo of something that maybe I was sort of trying to grasp and couldn't articulate about what this book, Ashland, has come to mean for me. The prose, I mean, to say the prose is, it's so lyrical and it's so poetic, is to diminish. People must find this book and read it and they will fall into it. It is some of the most beautiful writing that I've ever read. And sorry for the superlative, but I just had to say that about poetry and about how we need it. And I feel like in 2026, we really need it. So
I agree with everything you're saying. I mean, and thank you for finding that, you know, conversation with Colin Asher, who's a dear friend still. I saw him about a week ago, and Russell Banks, of course, has passed.
Yes.
But so there's so many things I want to say in response to that. But yes, I think that books should remind us of our humanity. I agree with Nelson Algren, again, not my idea, it was Algren's idea, that you need poetry in, you know, prose writing, in fiction, basically, he was saying. He said in a book, an interview book with him, that there's no good writing without poetry in it. The funny thing is, Algren wrote about regular people, but he even wrote about people who had been cast away, you know, people who had been thrown away by society. That's really basically who he wrote about, writing in Chicago in the 40s and the 50s. What I'm stumbling over saying is I resist the idea of an elite literature. I'm against it, basically.
Mm-hmm.
I think that literature should give voice to basic humanity. I think there's a great need for that and a great importance. and it has to be done in the right way. Algren did it in the right way. He looked up to his characters. He wrote about people who most of us or many of us would look down on. He looked up to them, and I hope I do the same thing. I look up to my characters. And so, you know, I think of this as a book for regular people, certainly, you know, in the ways that you're talking about. And then, you know, the other funny thing about me that relates to this is, you know, I'm not imitating anybody in my books. I'm not influenced by anybody in my books. But then in recent months, I've somehow come to understand in a way that I didn't before how influenced I am, not so much on the page, but in a kind of moral character way, mm-hmm. by some of the people that I've had the good fortune to work with as an editor, because, you know, my day job has been for many years an editor. So I worked with Kurt Vonnegut. I worked with the French memoirist Annie Ernaux. Nelson Algren, I worked on his books. He had died before I, you know, came to him. Mm-hmm. Barry Gifford, but Howard Zinn, you know, so these are people these are great writers and great Americans, okay?
Yeah.
Everybody I did, well, Annie Ernaux is a French woman.
Yeah.
But the others are great Americans, and she's an incredible force. So these are all, every one of the people I just mentioned are people who have defined what literature is in the 21st century. They did it mostly before the 21st century, and I had the privilege of working with them, and I did learn from them about something. Nobody would look at Ashland and say, oh, that's like Kurt Vonnegut's books.
No.
You know, but what I did learn from these people was, again, it's kind of a question of the power of good writing when it's done right, the power to connect, the way in which good writing is history.
Yes.
That's very true of Nelson Algren. You know, if you want to understand that period, which is to say the 40s, really, the 30s and the 40s, the Depression era, the post-Depression era, you know, you read Nelson Algren, he gets the history exactly right. You know, he's not like just making up stories. He's getting the history exactly right. How? Not by being a historian, but by fully imagining it with great care and great respect. So these are things that I aspire to, you know, in my work. It's kind of good values. It's kind of like I was brought up right. If you think of these people as my kind of parents in some weird way, and some of them, you know, I knew very, very, very well. And, you know, Annie Ernaux is still writing, of course. Barry Gifford is still writing, but the others have passed. So I think, I do think it's kind of a sacred, it's labor, it's nuts and bolts. It's at the same time, you know, it's down to earth. It's, you know, the same way as Carolyn, I think, is very matter of fact. When I picture her speaking these, I thought you spoke her very well, by the way. She's completely matter of fact, and at the same time, it's pure poetry.
Yeah.
But it's not kind of highfalutin. It's matter of fact. That's what she has the strength to do, is to observe herself mercilessly, by the way, herself.
Yes.
And everything around her. And that's what writing is to her.
Well, Dan Simon, what an honor to get to talk to you. What a thrill to get to talk to you about Ashland. Thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you, Yvette.
Dan Simon is the author of Ashland. This has been Book Public from Texas Public Radio. Jacob Rosati composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.